You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we look at what the Postmaster General said when questioned by members of Congress about some controversial changes to the Postal Service. First, COVID-19 has changed grocery shopping runs from a boring chore to an excursion. Some of us feel a great appreciation that at least one activity remains consistent, even though it might look a little different. While some popular items may be out of stock, there's still a lot of stuff to buy and eat, and the history of the supermarket is all about abundance and the appearance of abundance. Our next guest says the COVID-19 era is just the latest chapter in a long and changing history of the supermarket. Bianca Bosker is a contributing writer at The Atlantic. She wrote a recent piece about supermarkets. Bianca, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, you start your piece off on grocery stores. Looking back at your childhood memories of growing up, why does that strike a nostalgic chord with you?
Well, I think that I always felt this way, but I think a lot of people have also sparked sort of a reappreciation for the supermarket in the midst of everything that's been going on. And, you know, I would argue that supermarkets may be routine, but they are anything but ordinary. They are amazing, unlikely places that just sort of boggle the imagination when you get right down to it.
And in the span of human history, they're pretty new, and they were, you write, a really revolutionary innovation. Can you talk about sort of the before and after of the supermarket?
Yeah, totally revolutionary. So first, let's define what a supermarket is. So technically speaking, a supermarket is a place that houses between 15 to 60,000 different items that satisfy our desire to buy everything from tampons to sliced turkey within a single, you know, under a single roof. They're huge. They've about quadrupled in size in the last 90 years. The first one in America, I should say that, you know, they really are a pretty distinctly American phenomenon. The first one in the U.S. was actually emerged in 1930 in Jamaica, Queens, in New York. And they were just marvels. You have to keep in mind that for about 300 years before that, we would get things to eat, you know, in sort of outdoor markets, places that, you know, people would bring, you know, the meat to be butchered, produce. But these were places that had mud, there was flies, there was haggling, bargaining. And supermarkets really took the Fordist factory with its emphasis on efficiency and standardization and turned it into a place to shop for food. And they were actually so revolutionary that when Queen Elizabeth came on her first, I believe, official state visit to the United States, she specifically requested a tour of a Maryland giant food. Likewise, Boris Yeltsin, he also had a very official state visit to Texas and took an unscheduled detour to a Texas supermarket that is credited with souring him on communism, that he just saw this bounty of choice, this overwhelming, you know, encyclopedic choice that you find at the typical supermarket. So I think that's interesting to keep in mind when we perhaps grumble about having to, you know, roll our carts down the aisles.
And you write some about what a logistical feat it is to get stuff into stores, especially when it comes to produce. You spend some time with a trucker who, you know, will go from Washington to Florida or whatever with produce. Produce is a really fussy thing to carry in a truck, it turns out.
Yeah, so she, I wrote about the sort of different individuals that make up the supply chain. And supply chain is, I think, sometimes sounds like a boring word for what is a really miraculous operation, even more so in the midst of a pandemic. But yeah, so I spent some time speaking with a trucker who hauls reefer. And basically reefer, you know, is a refrigerated truck. And she spends a lot of time hauling produce, which is considered sort of one of the most finicky things that a trucker can move around the country, because it turns out that produce is very temperamental, right? It goes bad. It can get too cold. It can get too hot. Apples are very gassy, as it turns out, which can make a lot of other produce that it might travel with turn brown. So it really is, it's a feat. And it's one that was, you know, also difficult and concerning, especially because at the time when I was writing this piece in April, she found it really difficult to not only find masks and you know, Lysol, but even to find food. I mean, it was an incredible and depressing irony that here she was bringing, in this case, apples from Wenatchee, Washington to Florida. And, you know, she couldn't find sliced bread to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
We are talking about the history of the supermarket, how it's changed over the years, how it's changing today. Bianca Bosker is with us from The Atlantic. She wrote a piece, "The Pandemic Shows Us the Genius of Supermarkets." There have been changes in the current era, you write, not just because of COVID. There's a change in ownership with these investment groups buying grocery stores, and it doesn't turn out so great sometimes for the supermarkets and their customers.
Yeah, so I did kind of focus my story on a supermarket chain. I mean, sort of small, but it was growing, called Fairway, that was a real New York City institution. It's where my home is. And, you know, it did see this change of ownership and infusion of private equity money that we've seen really changing the landscape for many supermarkets around the country, and unfortunately not always for the better. I think the other thing that's interesting is the way that the supermarket is both, again, sort of seems like, well, I guess it seems a bit, you know, humble. It's where we get our staples, but the amount of research and kind of scientific papers that have looked at how we behave in supermarkets in order to try and tweak our behavior and get us to buy more is just fascinating. I mean, the science of supermarkets kind of blew my mind. I don't think I'll ever shop for groceries the same way again.
Well, what kind of things are they trying to figure out about how to get us to buy stuff?
Well, so first of all, like, what do they know? Well, what they found out through a combination of things like surveys and eye tracking and cameras is that we spend, well, a lot of our time in, quote, and this is an official scientific term, ineffective wandering at the supermarket. So the average supermarket visit, is about 13 minutes in length. And only about 30% of that time do we actually spend buying something. And when we do buy something, that process actually does happen pretty quickly. Apparently, it's on average 13 seconds, and that includes, you know, wandering down the aisle, finding the thing that you're looking for, and plucking it off the shelf. I mean, I feel like I spend that much time, you know, just staring slack-jawed at mustard alone. I mean, it's just, I don't know. But, you know, but I think that information is then used to determine planograms. So the layout of a supermarket is very carefully engineered down to the square inch. First, when you look at the whole level of the store, most supermarkets tend to be organized sort of what I would describe as like a reverse mullet. So you've got party in the front and business in the back. So you walk in and there's this abundant bounty of colorful produce. Whereas the staples, the things like your bread and milk, tends to be tucked further in the back. And there are various explanations for that, but one of them is really that by putting the things that we need to have further back, it does force us to walk through the whole store and hopefully pick up some things along the way. When you get down to the level of the shelf, again, you've got these planograms that take that information about, you know, studies that find that we think more highly of products placed on higher shelves and sort of meets out what products will go where based on that. So, for example, some grocers put their higher margin items at eye level because those move more quickly. We tend to buy more of them. On the other hand, data is one way to choose where things go, but cash is another. And many supermarkets do employ slotting fees, which basically means that, you know, you are seeing those cookies on that particular golden spot on the shelf because someone paid very handsomely to put them there.
I want to end on what might lead to a public service announcement here. You talk to also a retail worker, somebody who works at the checkout at a grocery store, and I've done this at a much smaller grocery store. Most people are nice. Some people are mean. And during COVID, this is a tough job. Can you talk about the experience that that she had at some of the tougher times?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, it seems like very difficult work, right? I mean, you're on your feet, you can get sore backs. And, you know, there's so many difficult parts of the job, but it was really disheartening to hear to what extent we, the customers, the people, were the disheartening part of the job, you know, really, you know, giving people a hard time, being rude, being gruff. And I was really inspired by this person who worked at a Fairway in New York City, who really, you know, actually just turned it into an opportunity to try and kind of turn people's days around, to kind of crack jokes, lighten their mood after waiting in these long lines. But, you know, it's incredibly difficult work. And again, people at all parts of the supply chain, the truckers, the cashiers, the people working, at the Hunts Point Market, for example, just really impressive. Again, amazing and extraordinary, even though it can feel very ordinary. And some might even say boring to go to the supermarket. I hope to change that perspective.
Bianca, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Bianca Bosker is a contributing writer at The Atlantic, where she wrote the piece, "The Pandemic Shows Us the Genius of Supermarkets." You can read more about what goes on behind the scenes at the supermarket. Coming up, we'll learn about a project to increase pollinator activity in and around Appleton and how to get involved yourself in making life better for your local bees. That's coming up next here on Central Time. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, what's happening with the Postal Service? What problems does it face and how can they be solved? We'll talk to an expert on government institutions about how they can better serve people. First, how much time would you say you spend thinking about the native pollinator diversity where you live? In other words, do you wonder about the health of your local bee population? If you're like Israel Del Toro, you think about it a lot. Israel's an assistant professor of biology at Lawrence University, and he's coordinator of the Appleton Pollinator Project, which is using the concept of citizen science to learn about and increase pollinators in urban spaces. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you've planted something in your yard, say, to help the local bees. Love to hear from you. Or if you have a question about your local bee population, 800-642-1234. Israel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Can you talk about the role our Wisconsin bees play in our lives, apart from, you know, making the honey?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we think about bees, we typically only associate the honeybee and maybe the bumblebee and maybe a couple of other species of bees that you might see in your backyard. But in reality, Wisconsin has over 500 different species of bees that are native to the state. That's a lot of biodiversity that remains relatively poorly understood. And sort of my job is to come in and figure out what we can do in our own backyards to improve the quality of lives for these organisms. So like I said, a lot of biodiversity out there, not a lot known about it.
And you're reaching out to community members in the Appleton area and neighboring cities. What are you asking the public to do to help track these bees?
So through an organization or a nonprofit organization called the Pollinablers Fox Cities, we've been working with the Fox Cities area, including Appleton, Nina, Menasha, basically any city along the Fox River, to try and change our habits to make our communities a little bit more bee friendly. We want folks to think about the necessities that our native pollinators have. So we might think of things like floral resources or flowers in your yard that bees forage for nectar and pollen for. But we also have to think about the nesting habitat. What sort of habitat are we providing for them to nest in? In fact, most of the bees that live in Wisconsin are ground nesters. So we have to think carefully about how to set aside some space for those bees to do well as well. We also have to think about things like their access to water. You know, sometimes we put bowls out for water for our honeybees, but how are we providing water, clean water resources for our native bees as well becomes an important issue.
Well, that's interesting. I know there are a lot of plants that we could plant to help out the bees. I hadn't heard as much about that nesting habitat. So if, say, somebody with a yard in the Appleton area wants to set aside some land, how do they make sure they create a bee-friendly housing site?
One of the best things that I tell people to do is to just let their yards be. I know that's punny and inappropriate, but just letting it be is an excellent way of making the right appropriate habitat space for your native pollinators. With dead branches on the ground, for example, or wood piles or stems that you don't trim or remove. So for example, I'm looking at my pollinator garden right now from my office window, and I see some old stems of some onion blooms that were around earlier in the season. I'm just going to let those stay in place. And the hollow stems are actually a great nesting habitat for some native bees. So it's just a matter of sort of taking a step back and doing a little bit less. We don't have to have this ideal, super tidy, pristine yard all the time. If you leave a little patch a little bit more disturbed and a little bit more wild looking, chances are you're going to be attracting a lot of your native pollinators as well.
Well, that's very encouraging, because then I can say I'm not lazy. I'm letting my lawn look that way for the bees. That's something we can do, right?
That was sort of the whole idea behind an earlier initiative that we had, was the No Mow May initiative, where we basically wanted to, on the other end of the year, provide early foraging resources for our native pollinators. And we did that by asking people not to mow their yards for the month of May. And so we called this initiative No Mow May. In the city of Appleton, nearly 500 people registered and participated on this event. And we basically let our lawns grow, and everything that was in there came to bloom and actually provided a significant boost in the abundances and the biodiversity of bees in our backyards.
Talking to Israel Del Toro from Lawrence University, biology professor there, coordinator of the Appleton Pollinator Project. We're talking about making safe space for bees in our lives and the benefits they bring us. You mentioned that was some spring activity. What do you have coming up in the fall and beyond at the Pollinator Project?
Yeah, a big thing that we want to do this fall is start getting ready for next year's plantings. It's actually not too late to start putting out seed for what pollinator plants you might want to consider having next year. So right around this time, this year's flowers and seeds have all come to bloom. Take a walk in your local park. Look for some of those native things like milkweeds and brown and black-eyed Susans or coneflowers, and grab a few seeds and just toss them in your yard. These seeds need a nice, hardy, cold winter to sort of treat the seed before it can actually bloom in the spring. So this is the time of year to start putting out seeds wherever you think you want to grow a pollinator garden in the future. This is also a good time to start thinking about letting some of that nesting habitat just sort of remain untouched and undisturbed. That's really important to maintain safe queens and let them overwinter through the following few months.
Can people get a little more creative with their plants? I planted this thing I'd never heard of called Joe Pye Weed. It's beautiful. It's a monster. And I can look out my window and it's BTV. With a little research, we can get pretty creative, right?
Absolutely. I mean, there are dozens and dozens of plant species out there. You know, it's a little bit hard talking to an audience that's Wisconsin-wide here and tell you specifically what's native in your neck of the woods, but talk to your local horticulturist. You know, do a little bit of research. There's plenty of online social media groups that have great advice on what's native in your own backyard and what's appropriate for your climate, your habitat, your soil type, so that you can provide some forage for next year's bees. And I also want to make a plug to not be discouraged and thinking about European honeybees as well. You know, most of my work and my research focuses on the 500 plus native bee species, but the European honeybee is part of our naturalized bee community. They are responsible for an important pollination ecosystem service. And so protecting those populations is also a future line of research of mine and a future interest.
And let's bring on a caller, actually. Ivy is with us in Evansville. Ivy, hi.
I just wanted to bring up a book that you probably know about. It's called The Bees in Your Backyard, which helps people identify those different bees, at least get you started on it. And it's kind of a neat book. I use it in my yard when I'm looking at the bees in my flower garden.
That's fantastic, yeah, Ivy. Thanks for sharing that. And Israel, you have some online resources to help identify some of our species, right?
Absolutely. So the UW-Madison Extension has a guide to some of the more common species that you're likely to see in the area. But as well, you can also try Google groups and Facebook groups, groups of people in social media that are sort of connected to the local bee communities. And if you want to, you can also check out our website. That's byobeez.org. So that's byobeez.org. And in our website, you'll find a list of native plants for the Fox Cities region, which is broadly applicable to much of Wisconsin, but also things, little tips and tricks and videos that you can use in your own backyard to help bees do better.
When I hear pollinators, Israel, I think bees and butterflies. It sounds like bees do most of the heavy lifting, but I also hear you saying things like planting plants that are going to help the bees and may help the butterflies too.
Absolutely. Pollinators are not just restricted to bees. Bees, you know, there's a lot of species. They're really, really abundant. And so we talk about bees a lot, but butterflies are also important pollinators. Bats are also important pollinators. Things that you often don't think about go. So by planting these native prairies and these native flora, you're actually helping out a plethora of the biodiversity in our backyard. So bees, beetles, there are butterflies, moths, all important pollinators in our urban ecosystems.
I know people around the state can do a lot of things you've been talking about, but if people want to get involved in the Fox Cities area in particular with your project, what do they do?
Yeah, reach out to us. There's a couple of Facebook pages and Facebook groups that you can reach us directly. That's one of them is the Appleton Pollinator Project, and the other one is Pollinablers Fox Cities. And this is a group of citizen scientists and citizen individuals who care about developing our community into a more sustainable and bee-friendly place. So we're working with local alderpersons to develop policy and initiatives that are going to go citywide and community-wide to try and enhance pollinator habitat, plant native floral resources, eliminate invasive species, make sure that we are essentially providing the best possible resources for our native bees. And in a world where our day-to-day news feed might be filled with gloomy news, bees are actually a little spot of sunshine. They, you know, there's a lot you can do and a lot you can physically control to actually help out the bees in your own backyard. So I encourage you to just start dabbling, get to know some of your neighbors, see what works, plant things like Joe Pye weed or butterfly weed, and you're going to see some great progress just outside your window.
Israel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thank you for having me.
That's Israel Del Toro, biology professor at Lawrence University. He's the coordinator of the Appleton Pollinator Project. He joined us for a look at the effort to boost bees in the Fox Cities. Coming up, the Postmaster General told members of Congress that the Postal Service has enough money to make it to 2021, but what comes after that? We'll check out the latest news and controversy over the USPS. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, it's a weekly focus on personal finance with a look at the benefits of frugality and how to practice it in our everyday lives. Get some advice and share your own examples. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Now, U.S. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy appeared before both Senate and House committees over the last few days. DeJoy only took the job a short time ago, but big changes to the Postal Service have happened under his watch, as well as some observable downturns in delivery service. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called representatives out of recess to an emergency session to address the problems. Don Kettle is the Sid Richardson Professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin, where he's focused on public management and policy. He's a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He is a former professor at UW-Madison, and a state commission was named after him here in the state. Don's latest book is called The Divided States of America, Why Federalism Doesn't Work. Don, welcome back to Central Time.
It is so good to be with you, Rob.
Well, DeJoy faced some tough questioning from Democrats in these appearances, including Representative Katie Porter of California. Here's a little bit of their exchange.
Do you know about within a million or so, can you tell me how many people voted by mail in the last presidential election?
No, I cannot.
To the nearest 10 million?
Is that a no,
Mr. DeJoy?
I would be guessing, and I don't want to guess.
Okay, so Mr. DeJoy, I'm concerned. I'm glad you know the price of a stamp, but I'm concerned about your understanding of this agency. And I'm particularly concerned about it because you started taking very decisive action when you became Postmaster General. You started directing the unplugging and destroying of machines, changing of employee procedures, and locking of collection boxes.
So, Don, we have the situation where the post office and the Postmaster General have become controversial. What do you make of these sometimes heated exchanges in front of Congress?
Well, there are a couple things going on here. The first is that quite obviously this has become a political football between the Democrats and Republicans. The president in particular concerned that the Democrats are going to try to expand vote by mail, which he thinks at least would advantage the Democrats. The Democrats, on the other hand, saying that anybody ought to be able to vote any way that they want. So it's become about voting, but there's a much bigger set of issues here about the future of the postal office that is lurking in the background here. So it's been really budding for a long time. That's all come to a head here together in the election campaign.
Yeah, let's broaden our lens here and look at the Postal Service and how it operates. It's expected, in effect, correct me if I'm wrong, Don, to be a revenue neutral service. Why the post office, out of the many things that the government does, why did this one become a revenue neutral, supposed to be self-funding service?
Once upon a time, there was the post office, and when it became the U.S. Postal Service, USPS, the expectation was that it would break even, that we would set the postal rates in a way that would ensure that it would generate enough revenue to cover its costs and that it would not be a drain on the taxpayers. The argument was that it should be just like an ordinary business, and as an ordinary business, ought to break even. But the challenge since is that so much has conspired to undermine its ability to be able to do that, that the rise of fax machines, the rise of email, the rise of FedEx and UPS, the rise of just the spread of email and social media now, to the point that it's very hard for the Postal Service to generate enough money to be able to do that. And on top of that, back in 2006, there was a decision, policy decision made, that the Postal Service would have to cover all of its pension obligations out for the next 75 years. So the combination of the decline in service on the one side, shrinking number of people actually using regular first-class mail, and on the other hand, the rising expenses because of the pension has really put the Postal Service in a terrible bind in terms of finding a way to break even.
And there's been an argument with especially the rise of the internet that, well, maybe the Postal Service is at least partially obsolete. It's not the vital function to communication that it was when it was, you know, put in the Constitution, that Congress had the power to make some kind of postal delivery system. Is there a case to be made there?
Well, it's certainly a much different kind of case than it would have been 5 years, 10 years, 20 years ago, before the rise, especially of the internet and social media. But on the other hand, there are lots of places in the country where it's hard to get internet service. There are lots of things that lots of communities that really depend on the post office for the delivery of all kinds of stuff. There is certainly the importance of the Postal Service in distributing advertising, but in lots of ways, there's everything from, say, prescription drugs that are delivered by U.S. Postal Service. That doesn't work real well on the internet. And there are increasing interactions between, say, Amazon and the Postal Service in terms of delivering lots of packages and lots of places that people increasingly depend on, along with the basic fact that there's been a principle from the very beginning. If you put a letter in the mail, for example, here in Austin and send it to Madison, it costs 55 cents. If you send it from Austin here across the street, it costs 55 cents. You have a basic principle, as there has been for a long time, that anybody can write to anybody anywhere for the same price, as a way to try to keep the country together. And that principle certainly hasn't changed at all.
Talking to Don Kettle from the University of Texas, Austin, about the United States Postal Service in a touchy political time, the Postmaster General testifying before Congress over changes there. You can join in with your thoughts about the role of the U.S. Postal Service at 800-642-1234. Well, now we have this pandemic, Don, and a lot more people in primaries so far voting by mail, an expectation that we'll have a lot of mail-in voting. And questions about how the postal system is going to deal with all of those ballots. What are you watching for there?
It's just a fascinating story. The Postmaster General was asked the other day how many ballots were cast by mail in the last election. The one thing we really don't even have a good idea about is how many will be cast by mail this election and whether or not the post office can handle it. And on the one hand, the basic question is if, in fact, the post office, the Postal Service, makes the right kind of decisions, that is, allows overtime, prioritizes the ballots coming through, and doesn't engage in a conscious effort to try to stop that in fact the ballots will get through. But on the other hand, at this point, we've already seen, according to some recent internal Postal Service documents, a decline in delivery by 8 to 10%. 46 states have been put on notice that it may be hard for them to try to complete mail-in ballots. So it's entirely possible we could end up having this go in a very bad direction. We have it in our power as a country to decide one way or another which way that goes in the next couple of weeks. And it's that that we need to pay super careful attention to ensure that, in fact, the voting process works.
And that's been the center of controversy. Changes at the Postal Service, as we heard a representative, a Democratic representative there, talking about unplugging or removing or otherwise shutting down sorting machines. Concerns about, as you mentioned, data on slowdowns, people raising concerns about getting their prescription medications when they need them, livestock deliveries, getting stuck in sorting facilities. How do we sort out what's going on internally at the U.S. Postal Service with these changes?
And the one thing that's certain is that neither of the extremes are correct on this. Those who are saying that it's a conscious effort to destroy the Postal Service are wrong. On the other hand, those who argue that there's nothing to see here, move along, are also wrong. There are two streams coming together simultaneously. One is that we have this long-running problem of trying to find ways of making the Postal Service more efficient and more effective at a time when its mail volume is going down and the costs are going up. And so there are lots of changes they've been making along the way, including sometimes taking some of these sorting machines out of service when they're maybe not being used as effectively as they could be. But on the other hand, it is also very clear that the new Postmaster General has, in the last 6 weeks or so, made a series of decisions that have, in fact, slowed down the delivery of the mail. And so we have this collision of these long-running economic challenges and short-term decisions that have been made. The long-term challenges we can't solve, although we can put them on hold until after the election, but it's the short-term decisions that the Postmaster General has made that he has in his power and that we have the ability to be able to oversee that can be reversed between now and the election to ensure that the ballots get out and then they're returned in time to be counted.
It's become a partisan issue. It seems like with Democrats and Republicans, it might be hard to come up with the right solution at the U.S. Postal Service. But what would you recommend for a process of evaluating the needs of the Postal Service financially and otherwise, and coming up with a plan to ensure its sustainability in the future?
Well, the first thing is that this is not a good time to have this discussion because it is, as you pointed out, Rob, inevitably tied up in the question of whether or not the mails can and should be used to vote. More and more states have been moving to online voting. More and more states have been moving to postal service and mail ballots. And the evidence so far is that the odds of fraud are very, 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 very tiny, so negligible as not really even to count. Given the fact that we have so much difficulty in trying to find ways of getting polling stations up and operational and having people have confidence to get out there to those polling stations to vote, expanding mail-in votes for this election is the best way to try to make sure that people who want to vote can. But after the election, we're going to have to come to the question of what is it we're going to do to try to shore up the Postal Service? Do we really expect it to at least break even? Do we expect that we're going to have to provide some public subsidy? How is the Postal Service going to make ends meet given competition from Amazon, and which has its own delivery service now, has its own airline even for that matter, as well as its own delivery trucks and UPS and FedEx? Not to mention what's happening with email and social media. What is, in fact, the future of the Postal Service, and what kind of financial circumstances should it try to set itself on a course for moving forward? And what should we do about this question about the pension funds moving forward as well? We really need a searching examination about the future of the Postal Service, but now, less than 2 months before the end stages of the campaign, that's not the time to have this discussion.
We're talking to Professor Don Kettle from the University of Texas, Austin, expert on public management and policy about the Postal Service, the testimony of Postmaster General Louis DeJoy, and the institution's role and future in our democracy. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you watch any of the Postmaster General's testimony over the last few days? What did you think? Do you think he got a fair shake from Democrats and Republicans? Do you think changes are needed for the U.S. Postal Service? Do you think it's obsolete? Do you think it's vital? Should Congress pass some emergency funding for the Postal Service? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the U.S. Postal Service and its future with University of Texas Austin Professor Don Kettle. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Questions you have for our guest about the management of the Postal Service, how it fits in to our U.S. government, problems facing, how it can be improved. Do you think changes need to be made, cutbacks in service or more funding for service from Congress? You can join in at 800-642-1234 or maybe email ideas@WPR.org. Don, I know one question with the Postal Service and people saying, well, maybe it can be replaced by UPS and things like that. Is what people call the last mile thing. In some rural communities, like it's like broadband, it's not profitable to go to those sparsely populated areas. Do we have anything to replace the Postal Service in those parts of the country?
Right now, we really don't, because the reality is a couple of things. One is there is this last mile principle, which is that one of the things that the Postal Service does increasingly is provides that last bit of service from a distribution center, maybe from, say, Amazon or your pharmacy to your doorstep. And so it's given the fact the Postal Service serves every address in the country, it provides a way to get those essential services out to everybody's doorstep. So that's one thing that's important. The other thing as well is that it's important to understand a couple things about FedEx and UPS, which are terrific services, but one is that they're a whole lot more expensive. There's no way to be able to mail anything in UPS or FedEx for 55 cents. That just can't be done. And the other thing, too, is that if you use UPS, they will deliver to some addresses and not others. There are some addresses that simply UPS will not serve, and it's maybe because they're way down the end of an alley or a street that is just too expensive for them to provide service to. They don't provide service to post office boxes, which a lot of people rely on. And so there's something about the fact that there is universal service to every address in the country for a low price that's long been the core from the very, very beginning, since Ben Franklin's days, about what it is that is the core of the Postal Service. And that's the problem with making an argument to replace it. It would cost a whole lot more money to mail things, and there are a lot of addresses where it wouldn't be possible to be able to do it. So the question is, what is it that we want to try to maintain here?
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us in Cedarburg. Jim, hi.
Hey, thank you, Professor Kettle. It's good to hear your voice. My question is basically, what's the history or the politics behind funding of the service, its pension for 75 years? Can you explain that? Do you have any knowledge to why they did that?
Sure. The basic question is this. The issue is that, in general, one of the things you do, as a basic principle of accounting, you don't want to discover as you wake up one morning and that you've got big pension obligations from people who have retired and that where you can't meet them. But the problem is that with the Postal Service, what they put together as a way to try to make a basic accounting decision back in 2006 has created an enormous financial obligation, because obviously there's some people who are going to be getting a pension in 75 years who haven't even been born yet. It is a basic principle that says if you stretch your contributions out over a long period of time, you don't end up finding yourself up against the wall when you finally need the money. But on the other hand, we're also paying now for pensions that are going to be not having to be paid out for a long time. If we wait for those pensions to come due, we may find ourselves under a big obligation. And a lot of companies, of course, find themselves in the same situation as well. But the Postal Service, because of the way in which it operates, is a very different kind of animal. And the fact that we shifted fairly quickly from a pay-as-you-go system to a system that says, let's put the money in the bank now for when we're going to need it later, has meant that we've had a big run-up of costs, and that's made it that much harder for the Postal Service to make ends meet. So kind of a complicated issue, good accounting reasons underlying it, but it's had huge implications now for the ability of the Postal Service to make ends meet.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Don Kettle from the University of Texas, looking at the U.S. Postal Service. Back to your calls now. Karen is with us in Madison. Karen, hi.
Hi. Could the speaker speak to the issue that I feel is going on
across the nation is that another disenfranchisement for Native Americans and people of color, black and brown, is the Postal Service. For instance, Native Americans on reservations have practically no postal service.
Karen, thanks for the call. Concerns about a lack of access to the Postal Service, Don.
Sure. And that's a good question, Karen. It has to do not only with people of color on reservations, but more generally access to services, because much of the same is true for some of the for-profit provisions as well. And the Postal Service has this challenge, this demand, this mandate of making sure that everyone has access to mail. They have a struggle trying to be able to do that, but relying on solely for-profit organizations to fill in the gap would in all likelihood make that problem even worse. And so that's the challenge and really the underlying philosophy that has guided the Postal Service from the very, very, very beginning. I can mail anything anywhere for the same price. And Ben Franklin had a rate chart that he used that they put together and when they created the postal office back at the very beginning, and it's the same principle today. Challenge is trying to find ways of making good on that promise, but it really does lie at the core.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Brian now in Middleton. Brian, hello.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yep. What did you want to bring up, Brian?
Well, I'm just saying that I think the Postal Service is a very beneficial service. As your guest probably knows, it's written into the Constitution. It's worked very well. And regarding the idea that it's not profitable, what other agencies of the government are profitable? For example, is the Air Force making a profit?
Brian, thanks a lot. That brings it back to a question we kind of started with, Don, why this one service is expected to break even at least, and most others are not.
Well, we have a couple of operations like, say, the Tennessee Valley Authority, which sells electric power, and some government training programs that actually do make a profit. And believe it or not, there are a few places in the federal government that do. But the basic principle has been, since we changed it to under the argument to make government run more like a business, if it's an enterprise, let's find a way to raise enough money to be able to pay for the costs. And that was back in the days when we paid a whole lot more attention to the question of the size of the government deficit, which we really aren't doing much of these days. But it's that basic principle, let's find a ways of making it work like an enterprise. But the problem here is finding a way to be able to do that. There are fierce battles in this business right now between not only the Postal Service, but Amazon's fighting with FedEx, Amazon's fighting with UPS. They're battling with each other right now over what the rates are going to be for delivery for Christmas season this year. So there's this really unbelievable, difficult transition that's going on under the surface that for the most part we don't see, but it's really reared its head precisely at election season now, having to do with this question of the ability of the Postal Service to be able to deliver the ballots that we're going to be casting for the presidency.
Don, I'm going to give you 30 seconds for a 30-minute question. Once upon a time, a Republican governor and Democratic lawmakers could ask a professor to convene a blue ribbon commission. Everybody would take it seriously going in. Do we have the capacity to do that? Can we agree to try to sort things out together anymore?
The two questions, two parts of this question. One is, can we do it then? There really are answers that we could come up with this. Can we have people to actually follow the results? I think the answer is yes. The time, as I suggested, is not to try to do it in the middle of a presidential campaign, but doing precisely what you said, Rob, after the election to figure out how we can make sure that the Postal Service serves Americans is, I think, precisely what we most need to do after the political dust settles. But in the meantime, we have an obligation to make sure that people who want to vote by mail can, because that's one of the things that lies at the very fabric of the basic American experiment here.
Don, thanks again for joining us.
So good to be with you, Rob.
Don Kettle is a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. We talked to him about the congressional testimony of Postmaster General Louis DeJoy, what's happening with the Postal Service, and the future of the institution. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a national organization is making the case that Election Day should be a day off of work for as many people as possible. They'll join the show to tell us why. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 7, cities and other local governments may be the next victims of the economic downturn caused by the coronavirus as they face declining revenues and increased public health costs. Find out how that could affect communities around Wisconsin tomorrow at 7 on the morning show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then travel writer and public television host Rick Steves tells us how he's keeping up his traveling mindset while staying home. He's got some great advice to share with us. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.